Changing the world with social media.
Jack and the engineering team put this limit on there of 140 so that they could allow space for the username. And there was an uproar. And Jack, being the lead engineer, sort of took charge and said, hey, look, that's actually a lot of space. One could change the world with 140 characters.
That's Twitter founder Dom Segola. We talk with him about his book, 140 Characters. It's a style guide for Twitter. And that's social media expert Chris Brogan. We talk with him about his book, Trust Agents. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Last week, I went to New York City to attend Social Media Week. A whole lot of people got together to talk about different ways authors, businesses, organizations, and just plain folks are using social media like Twitter, Facebook, and mobile apps like Foursquare. It was clear social media is becoming a major way, perhaps even the major way, companies and individuals are communicating with each other. My guest, Dom Segola, was one of the moving forces behind the creation of social media. He was part of the team that invented Twitter. About 20% of Americans have Twitter or Facebook accounts, with thousands adding new ones every day. Twitter is used for communicating just about anything to anyone, from the cute thing your dog did this morning to telling the world that a young woman was just shot down by Iranian paramilitary forces during an anti-government demonstration. But it didn't start out to be like that. It started out when a software engineer named Jack Dorsey approached the podcasting company Odeo, the company Dom Segola was working at. Dorsey wanted Odeo's help in creating a program that could send text messages between phones and computers so Dorsey could keep in touch with his friends. Over the some 4 years since Twitter was invented, Segola's been thinking a lot about how to use the 140-character platform, what he calls the short form, to communicate as effectively as possible. Now he's written a kind of Strunk and White style guide to Twitter, appropriately called 140 Characters. Well, Dom Segola, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
You helped to create Twitter while you worked for Odeon back in 2006. It's amazing. 2006, Twitter seems to have been around forever by now.
It seems like it really did pop right into our consciousness.
Yeah.
But there was a good deal of time where I spent many frustrated moments explaining it to people and to their dismay. It really was about a year, maybe 2 years before most people knew what it was.
What was the difficulty people were having with understanding it?
So at the time, you may recall, text messaging really wasn't as big of a phenomenon in the States as it was worldwide, primarily because we have these data networks. People could, you know, use a smartphone to just, you know, send email. Why would they bother with a text message? And so I think that was our original challenge, was that the service relied on text messaging to really show its value. And then when we started to build other things around that service, more features on the website, the ability to talk to other programs like TweetDeck or Tweety or Seismic, that it started to become more popular and more widely used, and used for different purposes as well. Because at first it was really just a sort of broadcast communication tool, and people started to bring the conversations to Twitter. And I think that's when it started to change its character a little bit.
A broadcast communications tool?
Yeah, little groups. That was the vision. We wanted to have everyone the ability to simply have their own dispatch, basically, so they could talk to their friends quickly from wherever they were.
Oh, I see. So it really didn't spring full-blown like Minerva from your head.
Well, it was really Jack's idea, and he had it for years, actually, and brought it with him to Odeo. And he was an engineer like me at the time, and when we had the chance to reinvent ourselves in the face of competition, we had a brainstorming activity called a hackathon, where we all sketched out our ideas. Jack shared it with us at first, just saying, I want the ability to send a text message to a group of people from wherever I am. And now it seems like a basic idea. Back then, it really was a kind of revolution, because there wasn't this ability before, at least not as easy as it is now. You could do it. You had to set yourself up, or you had to pay a fee, or you had to, you know, configure a service. But Jack wanted to make it so easy that you didn't even think about it.
But when you say Jack, you're talking about Jack Dorsey.
That's right.
And you quote him in the book as saying, one could change the world with 140 characters. What do you mean by that as well?
Let me give you some context to that quote. It was February of 2007, and the system had no limit at that time. It could send over 160 characters, and the system would send those messages out to your phone. And the original limitation of text messaging is a longer story, but it has to do with the sort of average number of characters in a sentence, which was written into a specification which got put onto cell phones. And so we were limited by that, and it was causing bugs. The system wouldn't deliver the things reliably, or it wouldn't deliver them in the right order. And so Jack and the engineering team put this limit on there of 140 so that they could allow space for the username. And there was an uproar, and a lot of folks didn't like that. And Jack, being the lead engineer, sort of took charge and said, hey, look, that's actually a lot of space. One could change the world with 140 characters. And when he wrote that, I happened to be watching, and I really resonated with that. I thought that was true. I really wanted to see that happen. And if not, you know, maybe be that writer. And it inspired me. So I bought the domain 140characters.com, and I started writing and blogging about this topic of, you know, great short-form writing. And I started noticing some patterns and some styles that were emerging, comedy, drama, conversation. And I started just taking notes. And so what it means to me is the evolution of this short format that started with perhaps even cave drawings, you know, the shortest form, the first words that had to be short by necessity, and then maybe going into some sort of modern conventions like the telegram, email, chat, definitely text messaging, and now Twitter and perhaps social networking in general. You know, even the email subject line is a part of the short format. So when he wrote that, I started watching, and I've noticed that it is becoming a sort of a social consciousness, this idea of short, quick, fast responses, fast, timely messages.
In your book, you say that in some ways it allows for even greater expression with 140 characters. I guess the discipline of it that makes one have the maximum punch with the minimum number of characters. Others might come back and say, well, this is just another example of attention deficit, of people not being able to think things through and really take the time to explore the long form. So could you contrast kind of the long form and the short form and what you think one is better for and what you think the other one is?
Sure. Let me define the short form as I think about it so people can get an idea. Basically, it's time sensitive. It is 140 to 160 characters, roughly. Back in the day, you used to pay per character with a telegram. And the other thing is it can include hypertext. And this is sort of something that folks overlook in terms of its power. Any number of those characters could be a URL, for example, which has a much longer format and could contain any kind of media. And so it's deceptive to think that it's simply just the words, because they have meaning when they're linked. But speaking specifically of text, when you see a URL, even if you don't visit that URL, if you know the shape of it, if you can decipher it for yourself, perhaps it's a username with an at symbol in front of it, the way it's linked now on the system. This hypertext has additional meaning beyond the actual characters themselves. Contrasting the different power and the different, like as you're saying, relevance of the two forms, in some sense, the short format both capitalizes and enables this kind of attention deficit system, where you expect things in short bites and you produce things in short bites. And so to kind of counteract that tendency, what I've tried to observe is how that habit of being short and concise is positive in conversation. And so what I've had is I wrote this book, which is a long book, about 200 pages, the longest thing I've ever produced, as a sort of compilation of short bits. And what I found is that the Twitter in real life leads to short, sharp thoughts. And if you can keep those short, sharp thoughts in your RAM, in your brain, for long enough, really, it leads to a very concise conversation. The trick is to line them all up and make sense of them. And that's what I tried to do with this book, and I found actually quite challenging after having spent some time, you know, years, writing just maybe one or two sentences a day of importance on Twitter and having to do that, you know, 1,000 words a day activity of writing a book. It really was a shock. And so in addition to the habit of having kind of quotes at your command. The other habit that it does is actually you kind of queue up your impressions of what's going on as if you were to tweet them. And I found this is very prominent behavior of people who use the blog format. Try to think about everything as if it's blog-worthy, and they'll try to be pithy, and they'll try to find a way to capture their audience's imagination by blogging what's going on. And they used to do it simply by writing about it later or taking notes or taking a photograph, and now you can simply tweet that. And so I at first found it a little bit disturbing that everything I did had some kind of label to it, and then I felt like I could tweet about it. This was back before the word tweet was really in common parlance. We used to just call it updating. And now, actually, I find it's a refreshing and a positive habit to think concisely about what I'm doing and actually to say, is this even worth talking about? And if it is, great. If it's not, why am I even doing it? And that's become kind of an interesting mantra for me.
That is interesting to hear, because so many people seem to tweet about things that really most other people aren't that interested in, you know, kind of that they're sitting with their dog watching TV right now. And you really argue in your book, 140 characters, you really argue for using this in a much more worthy way, in a much more weighty way, let's say, for really making changes in the world, or for talking to people and furthering conversations. Well, first of all, I want to ask you, you earned a degree in English literature. Is that right?
I did, from Swarthmore College in 1996.
Right. And so I'm sure you've read probably many, many classics, pre-computer classics, I would say, much less pre-Twitter classics. And you said you had some difficulty even going into a long, I mean, you say this is a long book, but it's a pretty short book as books go.
I had intended to be 140 pages just out of, just for marketing purposes, but right. I ended up a little over that. And I think it could be even longer, having gone through some of the styles. I was really surprised to see how many literary forms can fit in that space, or just a hint of those literary forms, like a poetry form or a dramatic form.
Okay, so, and I'm really asking this not to criticize by any means the short form, because it has its place, but I'm still struggling with what was the distance you had to cover to go from being an English major and having been steeped possibly in the classics, I would imagine, to this very terse form? What was the kind of internal journey that you had to make in order to traverse that territory?
Oh, great question. It's really a long story, but you know, I graduated with this degree and nothing to do with it. I thought I would be a journalist, and that was at the time when websites were just becoming a thing. As a company, you wanted to have a website, and I was hired actually into Silicon Valley as a webmaster, back when that was a real job name. So I had a choice of being an apprentice journalist or being this technologist, this engineer. And so I buried my pride a little bit and I decided to go deep undercover into Silicon Valley and watch for the things that I had anticipated as I graduated college, watch for the things that would change literature. I thought when I graduated, my thesis was that hypertext itself will change literature, the face of it, the production of it and the consumption of it irrevocably. And it was taking its time. And so rather than fumble around in its beginning, I thought I would contribute to that creation, and I became an engineer. But I still considered myself this writer, this journalist. And so I was watching. And as the technology evolved, I started participating in online communities and watching, you know, in chat rooms and using the early versions of chat systems and understanding that it's about not just the production and consumption of it, but the timing of that and the sort of community that's created around that behavior and the real connections between people. And I found that the shorter the format, the easier it is to consume and the faster connections can be made. It has this subsidiary effect, which I think you're hinting at, which is that it sort of fragments discussions and fragments people's thoughts, and it creates a sort of constant distraction. And my reaction to that is this book. I saw that happening once we had created this thing. And I saw that it was disrupting my life. You know, I couldn't not talk about it with my friends. It was becoming actually annoying because I couldn't tell the story succinctly. I needed the long format. And so I wrote this book originally as a series of blog posts, and even that wasn't enough. I had the help of this publishing company, Wiley & Sons, and their patients to try to string together for the first time a series of tweets throughout history that I thought were examples of great writing, not just good, but actually, you know, world-changing thoughts from important people like presidents and real journalists, and try to find examples of how to use this for good and how to use this most effectively. Because it's so easy, you can really do anything, and people do everything. But I think there, it's not a set of rules that I've laid out, but a set of guidelines, along with a book that I admire greatly, which is The Shrunken White's Elements of Style. I wanted to be something similar to that or complementary to that for this new short format.
We're talking with Dom Segola. He helped to create Twitter while working for Odeo in 2006, and he's written a book called 140 Characters. It's a style guide to the short form as in Twitter. So now let's talk about some of these guidelines you have there. You cover the basic grammar rules for short form writing. Give us some examples.
So you'll see occasionally in text messaging and in chat these abbreviations, and some call them leet speak or chat slang, and it's almost, you have to decipher some of these things, and I find that it's okay to pepper your speech with that, but if you rely heavily on that, you can be misunderstood, or you can appear not incompetent, but as if you're not trying hard enough. The use of those is endemic of someone at a certain stage of their kind of short format writing, and it's fine, actually. I think I find it entertaining, but it's something not to be overused.
Well, give us an example.
So the words BRB for be right back, any of these short form, like basically acronyms for phrases.
Or LOL.
LOL, which is commonly misunderstood. It can mean lots of love. It can mean laughing out loud. And typically I found if you write LOL, you're not really laughing. You're kind of chuckling. If you really are laughing out loud, you're going to be more extreme about it. You're going to say LOLZ, or you're going to really be creative with it and add exclamation points and ones and zeros and mistypes. And a lot of these sort of inside jokes of abbreviations come from mistyping things. Like if you're a gamer and you say you've won, or you've really trounced someone, you might say you've owned them. But if you are typing quickly, you might use a P instead of an O and say PWN, and that's become an abbreviation and an inside joke. So you've pwned someone. And you can even misspell that and get even more ironic with it. And it's almost, if you understand these rules, you can use them effectively and be ironic. But if you don't understand them and you kind of misuse them, it's easy to appear foolish.
And it sounds like it's the purpose is less communication and more kind of marking yourself as a member of a community.
Exactly, right. The speech that you use does identify you to different different writing communities, yeah, for sure. And I do try to use punctuation. That's another mark of thought. Because it is a challenge to put a real, choose the right words for 140 characters and use punctuation. I do spend sometimes minutes, and in fact, I used to have this habit of spending a whole day on a single message. Because
wow.
I knew what I would be doing every day. I was, you know, at that time I was job hunting, and I didn't really want to talk about the job hunt. I wanted to talk about my adventures and try to put myself out there. And so I thought, well, every day I'm going to write about my surfing, because that was how I was getting through the period between layoff of Odeo and my job after that at Adobe. I could, to get over myself and to get over the experience of being laid off, I went surfing every day. And then this is also part of the story, as you're saying, about how did I come to this realization about the effectiveness of short form. It is, I had to split my personality from my main account, which is Dom, at Dom, and my kind of sporting account, which was the surfing activity, which I had to do to get by. And so I created at Surf, and suddenly I had these two accounts, and I could write about anything I wanted to this new audience, and it was so liberating. I would spend all day thinking about what I would write and the words I'd use, and then wait for that moment to come and be inspired to finish the sentence and finish the thought. And so I'd write every day, just once a day, and that sounds a little bit silly or even impossible for some people, but really it's a great discipline, and if you can try it for like a week, you'd be surprised at what might happen. And it's perfectly fine, by the way, to have more than one account. I won't even tell you how many I have, but some of them are listed in the book. But I've kind of collected these different ways of writing and these different audiences for different account names that I can rely on, and I can meet their expectations. So if I have a joke, for example, that I think might not really fit the sensibilities of my larger audience, I have a sub-audience that I can trust out jokes with. They're my high school friends and college friends, and folks that I've collected, you know, through that personality.
That's actually a wonderful story, and I wanted to say about punctuation. Punctuation itself is a very terse way of creating meaning. And I find it incredibly useful with Twitter because I only have 140 characters, and I can use punctuation instead of a whole lot of words in order to make a point.
Absolutely. I have a couple of conventions I've come up with that I'm going to regret passing on because now I won't be the only one. It won't be as much of my unique style, but I should share them because they're effective. One is the EM dash, and it's longer than a regular dash. If you are using the Macintosh keyboard, you want to use the Option key and then the dash. And I think it does show up on your text message as well. And what it does is it's a longer dash, so it creates some space, but you can skip having the dash, the spaces before and after the dash. So you're saving yourself two spaces essentially,
mm-hmm.
or one if you're just going to cut yourself off with a regular dash. So it's very effective. You can separate thoughts that way visually. And it allows you to almost put two thoughts into one sentence because you do sort of cut yourself off. You can say something and then, you know, use the EM dash and be even more excited in the next phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And it builds some personality into, or builds some energy into that update. Another one, I found a couple of shortenings that I can rely on that are so common that I don't feel like I'm cheating. One is, if I really have to, I'll use W slash instead of with. The other is, I'll use the ampersand instead of AND. It is so common and in naming and in other things that it's almost acceptable to me. So I use it a lot to save space if I have to.
Almost acceptable?
Well, it's definitely cheating. I mean, we should be using the full word.
Really?
I think here's my entire premise. Word choice is really what it's about. And so if you can find a smaller word that's more powerful, use it. Every word does have its lineage, and even the connecting words. One thing I've noticed is I really do, when I'm writing a tweet or an update on my Facebook, I notice if I'm using multiple phrases, I'm here at Wiley in an interview with, you know, so if I'm careful, I only use one or two instead of three or four of those connecting words. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
And even the connection, even those connecting words and the pronouns, they all matter. And I think that's what it's taught me is that it's hard enough to simply get your thought in there. But if you can do it with a little bit of style and do it so that it can not just fit into a tweet, but maybe be written onto a T-shirt or on your an actual postcard and sent to someone, or something that you would actually use outside of the context of that message, then it's really going to translate.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's one thing to throw a URL in there and a couple of at symbols and say that you're creating a conversation. But if for example, the words "one could change the world in 140 characters, I mean, that got printed into a book, it's been in many headlines, it's been in several articles, that's something that's translated across the media. And I found that's really important. I've been challenged by some of the things that have come up since the creation of Twitter, like the Threadless. Threadless is a T-shirt company, and they did a contest where they were pulling in great tweets, and then folks could vote on them, and they would become part of their T-shirt printing specials. And so they just produced a series of T-shirts that are based on tweets.
Cool. And what's the name of that?
It's called Threadless.
How do you spell that?
Threadless.
Oh, great. Let's look at that quote, actually. You can change the world in 140 characters. There's a certain sense of a little bit of irony behind that.
Mm.
You know, a little bit of sense of, oh my goodness, something so simple as 140 characters and you can change the world?
Mm. It is a little bit of a challenge to say. It was almost taunting when he wrote that, as well as being kind of a truism. I really, when I read that, I thought, well, it's going to have to be the right person writing that in 140 characters. That was my immediate reaction to that thought, which is it's going to be a president or a great leader who says that thing, and it's going to happen just at the right time, perhaps even a commentary on the times. And so I started to follow these people. And one of them happened to be Barack Obama. Early on, he was part of Twitter. He started writing. It seemed like he was writing himself, or at least it seemed to have his style to it. And it turns out he was the most popular, most followed user on the system when he was elected. Huh. And so there's an example of someone who could possibly change the world with his 140 characters.
And you created an Obama 08 phone app.
Right. We a team of 10 in total secrecy for 21 days produced this application to the specification of the team, the Obama campaign, for their use in basically getting out the vote. And it had 7 features. The most important and interesting feature was one called Call Friends. And all it did was sort your contact list by swing state, by battleground state, in order of importance. And so you would call your friends and family and tell them what you'd learned through this app, which had a series of position points and connection points and how to find out more. And you just try to change their minds or get them to act on behalf of the campaign. And it was very effective. We had over 41,000 phone calls generated by the system that we were tracking anonymously. As people would make calls, the system would register that you'd called someone, but not your name, just that you'd made a call. And so we were able to track over 11,000 people calling.
Wow.
During the 30 days before the election. And so that was really, I think, a good demonstration of the engaging people on their mobile to talk to and organize with other people on their mobile specifically. And that's the power we had originally with Twitter, was that it was entirely based, the experience was entirely based on being mobile. Focusing on text messaging as our first application of the idea really enabled us to realize, if you're getting a message, it's coming from one of your friends that you've personally evangelized and basically pushed into the system, because at the time no one could understand what its value was. You had to simply sort of recruit people. And then you knew it was coming from their mobile device because it was the only way to use it. And there was a certain immediacy to that. And similarly with the Obama app, there was an immediacy to using your iPhone to connect with other iPhone users.
And people must have been texting with this as well, is that right?
That's right. So yeah. Combined with the Call Friends feature, there was you could sign up for updates. You could find the local headquarters based on your location. You can read their news and watch the videos and all the things that they were producing. It's actually I still have it on my phone. It's not available on the store anymore. And that location feed still works. I can still go anywhere I am in the world as I travel around and show this app and say, there's something happening around the corner tomorrow, and actually still organize with people. So we're hopefully going to try to resurrect that application.
Really? And to resurrect it for Obama or for people in general to use in organizing, whatever they want to?
Well, it's a conversation. So we're still, the team has sort of scattered, but we're still collected by this experience of having done it together. And I think we all really enjoyed working together, so we want to try to do something similar together.
Hmm. I asked Dom Segola where he sees this mode of communication going in the future.
I see it as an opportunity for other communities that don't already have rich data networks to experience some kind of internet. And so what I've seen and what I've heard from folks who've traveled into some really desperate places is that cell phones are the first computer that folks actually have contact with. They're skipping the desktop experience and going right to mobile, much in the way that that phones in some countries don't even rely on landlines. They use cell towers as their first infrastructure. So, where we had this instant community of people that were coworkers and who really needed to be connected, I see that popping up around the world, where these communities are really needed. Folks need to kind of band together and support each other and be aware of each other's activity, whether it's organizing in Iran or farming in a far off land that's very difficult to farm, or just organizing as a community around an election, around a disaster, perhaps, an event. I see that opportunity rather than focus. I focus on that rather than the sort of possible downside here in the first world or whatever. Because we're going to normalize. We as a society here are going to normalize. We'll decide at some point that this overlay of our lives is either superfluous or has a certain place. And some people will use it, some people won't. And that's just going to be the way of it. I've learned that. But now we have a much broader audience and a much greater set of voices to possibly listen to, because all it takes is a cell phone. And so if we can bring that capability to places where it's really needed, I think we'll see the value and the future of this communication medium much more than if we focus on kind of the struggles we have here, because we have so many ways to actually connect and communicate that it does seem a little bit like a little. I guess the word is ephemeral. That's the word I've heard a lot, that it's transitory. But I think possibly that the message that will change the world may come from a writer who's never actually touched a computer. It may come from someone who's reaching out for help somewhere in a disaster-stricken area, or someone who has a revolutionary thought in the middle of farmland in Africa. I do think we have yet to see the real power of this medium, and that's what's inspiring to me.
Well, Dom Segola, your book is 140 characters, a style guide to the short form. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Dom Segola, go to writersvoice.net for a web-only extra about how the role of Twitter during the anti-government demonstrations in Iran started him thinking about how to protect your identity on Twitter. Next up, we talk with Chris Brogan about how social media can be used to build your reputation and your brand. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On February 6, people in Western New England came together for a podcamp held at Westfield State College. Podcasting is how people can subscribe to the audio or video content from their favorite shows, like Writer's Voice. Back in 2006, Writer's Voice webmaster Bill Way and I went to PodCamp Boston. Chris Brogan was one of the organizers of PodCamp Boston. He's gone on to become an expert in the area of social media in general and how to use it in the community and in business. Brogan says over 70% of people polled will trust an opinion that they read online, whether or not they know the author of the opinion. He wants to make sure their trust isn't misplaced. So he's written the book, Trust Agents, Using the Web to Build Influence, Improve Reputation, and Earn Trust. He talked to Bill Way and I recently in a fascinating interview that ranged wide over the subject of social media. Chris Brogan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
My pleasure to be here.
Hi, Chris.
How are you doing, Bill?
Good.
Explain to us, first off, this idea of trust. I mean, when I first saw the name trust agents, I really didn't know what it meant.
The idea of trust agent is somebody who can help a company or even as an individual learn how to be human at a distance. And what that means is, if you think about the way the web first was, it was very much like a bunch of brochureware. It was, you'd go to a site, you'd look at the banners, you'd look at the buttons, you'd either click and buy something, or more often than not, you'd wander off and look at something else that caught your attention. And the social web, it's very much more a two-way web. We're looking for interaction, we're looking for conversation, we're looking for a chance to build relationships. And so the opportunity in writing the book and talking about trust agents was to explain how these businesses are starting to use human entities to help them with their business communications, be that marketing, customer service, PR, or a mix of the above. And so we see this as an opportunity or a chance to educate folks on how these tools are being used, and not so much talk about the tools. I mean, it's not really a book about how to use Twitter or Facebook or something. It's more a book about how can we connect with each other and see the human behind all of the detail on the web.
Chris, talk a bit more about using the word agent.
Yeah, so the idea is that an agent can be someone representative of another entity. So an agent is usually, I'm someone who stands in on your behalf. One of the trust agents we wrote about was Frank Eliason from Comcast. And Frank very single-handedly turned Comcast's customer service on its head by starting to answer people via Twitter. And he got a lot of press for it. And basically, we came to think of this faceless entity, this large cable company in the U.S., as being someone who wouldn't respond, someone who didn't necessarily answer the phone or give us what we wanted, to being this guy Frank, that, you know, did seem like he cared and did really want to help. And now he's got 10 employees that are doing the same sort of thing. And it's really changed the way customer service is being looked at now, in, you know, at least via the social web. And we're starting to see that branch out to a lot more companies.
In particular about Frank at Comcast, I'm not sure if this was the first time it happened, but it was the first time that what he was doing came across my screen or in my field, was his interaction with CeCe Chapman. I think it was either on his Twitter feed or on his blog, or maybe in his in CeCe Chapman's podcast, where he was having a problem with his cable, and he kind of, it was on Twitter, right? And he said he had some kind of general complaint, you know, like kind of those, you know, Primal Scream type of tweets about his cable, and within, you know, an hour or two, he had gotten a response from Comcast, and it kind of blew him away.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those experiences that more and more people are reporting and having happen. That's one of the things that we like about talking about trust agents, is that some people come at it thinking it's a social media tools book. Some people think it's a book about blogging or those kinds of things. Other people think it's a book for marketers. But to me, it's a communications conversation, and or it's a conversation about what we're starting to call human business, and how this human business works.
Yeah, well, that really feeds very well into my question. Just as Bill asked about the word agents, I want to ask you more about the word trust. Business and trust are something that, you know, is a bit of an oxymoron these days. So talk to us about how one builds trust in a way that is, you know, has true integrity.
I think it's a unfortunate or fortunate accident that our book hits at a time when trust in business is probably at its lowest in several years. And we're having a really tough time. And in a lot of these situations, you know, a lot of people are losing their jobs. The unemployment rate's hovering around 10% nationally. And we're at a spot where part of that erosion came from people falling out of trust with people. Our book doesn't hit that directly, but instead what we looked at are, what are the ways in which the web has changed some of our perceptions on trust? For example, when we go to make a buying decision, in polls, 90% of people ask somebody that they know whether or not to buy XYZ. So let's say it's a digital camera. If you asked me, I would say I love my Panasonic Lumix DMC LX3 camera, and I think it's just amazing. And
now, that's not product placement, is there?
Heck no, I wish. You know, I had to buy that baby out of my own pocket. But I love it. And so I'll sing its praises back and forth, that everybody's excited. But an interesting fact that we also learned was that over 70% of people polled will trust an opinion that they read online, whether or not they know the author of the opinion. So they just, I read it on the web, it must be true. And so this kind of floored us a little bit, and we found a little bit more factoids like that. We also found that a lot of times, just in having a website, there are little cues that either positively impact our belief in their authority or negatively impact it. You know, for example, if the website's just somewhat a very generic blog template on a very common hosted blog, you may or may not ascribe a little less value to that. You might say, well, it doesn't look like it's been around very long. It doesn't look like they put much into it. It seems maybe fly-by-night-ish. And so we started to really peel through what kinds of things on the web gave us a feeling of trust or not, and or how as a human can you conduct yourself in ways that would maybe build a little bit more reputation and a little bit more trust.
Do you want to tell us some of the high points of what are the ways to build that trust?
One of the things we talk a lot about is how not to be that guy. Mm-hmm. When we say that, there seems to be this culture for marketers, at least, or salespeople on the web, to very much come rushing at you and try to push their products on you and really just give the whole art of sales and the art of marketing a bad name. And so we talk about, you know, how to promote other people 12 times as much as you promote yourself, how to build a relationship long before you need the sale so that people don't feel like you've come out of nowhere, how to use the social tools appropriately such that you take the extra time to put a picture of yourself on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, and you make sure that people understand with whom they're dealing. And so there's a lot of steps that one could take to really improve their opportunities should that be one of their goals, is to make sales. Because there's just so much that mirrors how we would really do it in real life that people somehow throw out once they hit the web. So we're just kind of gently guiding people back to the fact that you actually do need to make relationships before you make most sales.
I was wondering if you could address sort of this contradiction, or the potential contradiction, between a trust agent and their perceived integrity and ethics, and maybe the business that they're working for, who may not have that same reputation.
Like Comcast.
So what's really interesting, or what's really fun about this space, is that the web really lays bare the disparity between what someone wishes to believe about them and what you can find out about them. And you don't really have to do a whole lot of effort to use Google and start to know whether or not somebody is telling you what is real, or whether or not they're telling you what they wish you'd believe, because the social press, I mean, one of the things that Julian Smith, my co-author, says a lot, is a sort of a joke now, is he goes, oh, so you're a blogger? What do you complain about? Because it seems like the social web has built this great ecosystem of the ability to complain about things, and I most certainly take advantage of it, just like most people do. And if I feel like I've been wronged by some company, that's what my audience is for, is to share that feeling. And so one of the things is that should someone try to employ the tools and the ideas and the methods of being a trust agent, but it's just not in sync with what the rest of the company's doing, it comes obvious fairly quickly if the rest of the practices don't align. Now, in the case of someone like Comcast, it is understood that their mainstream customer service, their phone customer service, still needs help. But, I mean, I think most large organizations that have a heavy customer service requirement need help. I think that it's so less obvious that a company like Zappos comes along, who, you know, is an online shoe retailer. Well, they sell much more than shoes, but that's why most people know them, and gets sold to Amazon for what amounted to over $1 billion, because Jeff Bezos said that Tony Hsieh built the level of customer service that he couldn't, that Jeff couldn't attain, even though he considered his customer service world class.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that puts a direct monetary valuation on customer service. It's worth at least $1 billion, at least to Jeff Bezos. So extrapolating that backwards into a place like Comcast, I mean, they're striving for better customer service, and that Frank was able to show sort of a new way of doing it gives them sort of a new opportunity to go backwards through their operations and do more stuff. So I think we'll see some companies that stumble, whether or not they're stumbling because they're just trying to pay lip service to these ideas, or whether they stumble because it's just going to take them a little while to learn. We'll have to wait in before we pass judgment, I think.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Chris Brogan. He is the co-author of Trust Agents. Chris, one of the people that you talk about in Trust Agents is Robert Scoble, who I think is an interesting case study in a trust agent for a couple of different reasons. One, because of his former association with Microsoft, but also he changes jobs and he takes his, or he's built up a personal trust among people in the who are versed in his name and in the web and follow his blog, and he's transferred that to different companies. So could you talk a bit about Robert Scoble and sort of how he does this?
Yeah, so in his first iteration that anyone really knew about him, I mean, he had a life before the web, but it was only reaching a certain group of people. He used to run a small camera store or manage a small camera store, and he was basically doing the same sort of thing then. He was giving his opinions about various cameras, and people would believe him because he would say the good and the bad of every brand. Well, at Microsoft, Robert Scoble, he was blogging and making media, and he was building a bit of a following, but just sort of as yet another nerd. But the shot heard around the world was the day that he said, how come Internet Explorer can't be as cool as Firefox? These are two different web browsers. And people went, whoa, he just called out his own company. And so we all just waited around to see if he'd get fired. And in the meantime, we all thought, wow, that's great. I mean, we'd totally believe him. And sort of the running joke is that if the very next day he said that Notepad was the best software that Microsoft ever made, we would have agreed with him for that, too. But so Robert really built in a short time a following of people who believed that if he said this was a good product, we'd agree with him. And if he said this wasn't, we'd agree with him, because we knew that he wasn't shilling for Microsoft, because he was willing to put them right out on the table as something that needs fixing, just like he would any other company. And so he built quite a following. When he left for Fast Company, and there's a sort of a misedit in the book, because we wrote it so long, you know, it takes forever to write a book, or rather it takes forever before it comes to market. So Robert, in his pull quotes, talks about working at Rackspace, and on the so Fast Company hired him very much because he was this name, this entity, and they believed that just by making media with him, it would draw lots of eyeballs and lots of attention and build lots of business revenue. And it did okay, but it didn't do it fast enough, I don't think, and Fast Company reconsidered their use of social media and sort of very quickly lost most of the social media people that were working there. They had Shel Israel for a little while. That fell through. Scoble left, and so did Lynn D. Johnson, who's a friend of mine, who then went on to other business. And so Scoble moved on. He moved to Rackspace, which is probably the most interesting of the issues. It's almost like the Microsoft thing, where he was making media for a software company. Well, now he's making media for a hosting company.
Yeah, what is Rackspace?
Rackspace is a software hosting company, internet hosting company, so that they offer everything from servers hosting for big companies to internet cloud hosting for anything up to and including blogs. For example, my blog, chrisbruggen.com, is hosted by Rackspace, and they sponsor that hosting for me, so that is placement. They hired Scoble because they thought that his ideas of creating interesting media for the tech set would be sort of an interesting lead-generating opportunity for Rackspace to feel like they had an interesting name in the business. So it'll be an interesting relationship to watch. It's been just under a year at the time of this recording, and the question is, will Rackspace continue to feel that there's enough business value to keep that relationship going, and are they finding sales? I mean, there's something really different in the social media space right now for business. It's very much put your money where your mouth is, and 2010 will show a lot of shakeout in this space, and it will either abandon it as a fad that didn't work, or people who feel like they've got the angle on it will continue to prosper and make business happen.
In your book, it's primarily, as you say right in the beginning, that your audience is business or people wanting to be trust agents. But my question is, what does it feel like looking through the looking glass from the other side of just your average person? I don't know, my mother, who's started using the internet and got her first computer, I think maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and she's 70 years old now. If you're on the receiving end of this kind of communication, what does that feel like?
Well, Bill, I guess it always depends on who the person is that's making the relationship. So Paula Berg, who up until very recently worked with Southwest Airlines, if your mother was on Twitter and she was complaining that, you know, Southwest lost her luggage, then Paula would go out of her way to get your mom's phone number and talk to her and walk her right through the process of getting everything handled, because she's listening on the social web for that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure your mom would come away thinking, holy cannoli, that was the coolest thing that ever happened to me. I really felt like I was well-treated. So the people who are sort of recipients of this usually will come away with a feeling that they're being well-treated. Because, again, the idea is not to be in someone's face, to be there before the sale, not to try to push things that people don't need. It's very much the opposite of old-fashioned outbound marketing and sales. It's what the folks at HubSpot call inbound marketing, which is the idea that, you know, if you do good, if you produce good things, if you are in the places where your would-be buyers would be, then you're going to have a better chance of making sales than if you're creating, you know, interruptions and pushing people towards a purchase.
Could you talk a bit more about the personal and how personal communication happens on the web, which I think can be an oxymoron?
Well, you know, you would think so, and yet, wow, there's so much to go into here, Bill. The idea of credibility and trust and personal communications, it's exactly that. I mean, blogging is a much more personal style communications format than, say, article writing for magazines. And we've already seen that, you know, the magazine industry in general is down about 89% in revenue and all that, and people are getting laid off like they're going out of business. And at the same time, the remaining journalists are being told you must blog as well as write your feature articles. And the reason is we're connecting with that sort of personal feeling. feeling, one-on-one feeling communications. I was on Dr. Phil's show as their expert person to talk about whether or not you can build relationships over the web or what these things feel like and all that. And one of the questions Phil threw at me, which was way off the map of where he said he was going to go, is Dr. Phil asked me, you know, well, can you feel emotions over the internet? Can you really actually start relationships over the internet? And I said, gosh, I hope so. I met my wife that way.
Wow.
And he said, well, yeah, but you eventually met her in person. And again, I said, I hope so. I have two kids that I know of. So I think that you can feel emotions over the web, and I think that's one of the things that people who aren't as privy to that or who aren't feeling that yet don't get, is that sometimes they can be hurtful or sometimes they can not take people's emotions or feelings into account because there's that digital divide, and yet it's every bit as much as real. I mean, if you think about it, we're doing a telephone interview, and 100 years ago we would have said that was terrible. How could we possibly talk over wires when we should be face-to-face at a gathering? But the personal thing, the way I describe it to business is, I said, if you think of advertising and marketing and your other business communications as theater, then look at this as theater in the round. And you still have some privacy. You still have things that you don't necessarily want to share. You still may or may not follow some idea of a guided conversation. But you do have to have more dimension to what you're doing, and you do have to have more conversational openers instead of just a one-way street.
The Web 2.0 is so different from the first web that we knew, which, of course, was even more vastly different from the Internet before the web happened. Where do you see things going in terms of social media and the web, the Web 3.0 or 4.0?
Well, social media might be a slightly different answer than the web overall. The web overall, I think, is hopefully moving towards this sort of Internet of Things and location and mobile type thing. So I think we see some of that with the advent of the iPhone and the new Android-type phones, all the smartphones that are out there. We see the first experiences of what location-based web can feel like, and, you know, when objects have an Internet address and when these objects can communicate both in a virtual space and the real space. You know, for example, with the newer iPhone, I can be in front of a restaurant and wave my Yelp application in front of it, and it'll tell me the restaurant reviews without me having to do anything. So it floats the star rating right over the restaurant. This is not science fiction, it's now. So that's the web in general. With the social web, I think what's going to happen is we'll go into this experience that I call velvet rope social networks, which means we'll have a lot more niche-based, smaller, sometimes private communities, and it won't be a question of who has 100,000 followers on Twitter. It'll be, you know, I'm hanging out with my writers community right now, and we're only talking about writing, and so if you want to talk about baseball, you'll have to go over to the Babes baseball community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what comes next. I think of Facebook and or Twitter as the commons, where we're all sort of in this big park, and we are all having a conversation, but it's not always about the same thing or with the same people. And I think we'll find ways to sort of slice rooms or something off of this stream of life. And an example of that would be Sermo, which is a private professional network for medical practitioners. And so it acts a bit like Facebook, but only for the sort of doctor crowd. And we'll see a bit more of that. StockTwits, Howard Lindzen's project, which is actually built on the back of Twitter, just got funding. So it's interesting to see somebody who built a sort of ancillary business on top of Twitter receive a few million bucks to try to develop it more.
Looking back, and I think you did the best you could in terms of like future-proofing Trust Agents, the book, and not focusing solely on the tools because they're always changing. But looking back on your book, is there anything that you've learned since it's been published and you've gone and you've done hundreds of interviews that you wish you could go back and change?
Oh, of course. I mean, remember, I'm a blogger first and foremost. I mean, when I write iteratively, I write on the web, I write with this idea that I can use links and I can pass information back and forth and that it could be time-based instead of, sitting there on a shelf. And writing a book is like this weird process of making kimchi. I mean, you just put all this cabbage into a container and you stick it in the ground for a few months and then you eat the fermentation of it. You know, we passed in our final manuscript months and months and months before it came out. And then what I learned when talking to some agents, because Julian and I didn't have an agent for this book, we just handed it in. they said, oh, well, you know, Wiley's pretty good. They have about a six-month, you know, gap between when you hand it in and when it hits the press, but a lot of the other ones go as far as up to like 12 to 18 months. And I said, my gosh, I'll never have to write another mainstream book again, because how can I predict 18 months from now if that I still feel the same way? So that's just a little under the kimono of the whole process of it, Bill. But in writing Trust Agents, Julian and I did come away, there's this cliche that says when you finish a book, you come away with ideas, you know, that you didn't have before. And we really did. And we came away with this whole idea that there's more to this, how does human business work beyond just communications or marketing or whatever. How do people who maybe grew up using the internet as one of our business tools or as our business entirely, how do we look at entrepreneurship? How do we look at doing business? And how do we look at sort of a people-focused business model as opposed to older generations who maybe were going strictly from revenue and some of the other motivators?
So you're actually saying this is where you're kind of crossing some of the, or melding with some of the thinking in the sustainability business community, which I write about, I blog about. You know, the idea that the triple bottom line there is people, profits, and planet. Of course, there's the environmental component. It sounds to me you're talking about a double bottom line here, people and as well as revenue.
Absolutely. Yes, I think that, to me, it's this whole idea, and I said it on a stage, and it's to Bill's question earlier about how do you look at a book when it's finished and pick at it again and want to look at all the parts you want to change. One of the things I shouted at a stage during a passionate moment was, we're farmers and stewards, not machinists. And I wish to God that was in my book because I liked it so much. But when I say that, I mean, we cultivate, we grow, we weed, we water, we feed, and then we take some part of the harvest and then we keep the rest so that we can grow more crops for the next year. This, to me, is, you know, so far from how we do business nowadays. And to me, in the business I've created for myself and the money that I make as my company, New Marketing Labs and Chris Brogan as two separate businesses, has been built on this sustainable harvesting kind of model, and it's working great. So I don't know that General Electric or General Motors, even though they've spent time with me, are willing to take my model. But I do know that sort of the mom and pops and the small mid-sized businesses really could do a lot to follow in those kind of models of, you know, farming and stewardship, as opposed to being microcosms of the industrial businesses. And that's sort of the big passion that Julian and I are talking about for our joint project. There's a book I have coming out in between that, but the next time you see Julian and I together on the same book cover, it'll be about that.
Your book is Trust Agents, Using the Web to Build Influence, Improve Reputation, and Earn Trust. This has been a fascinating conversation. Chris Brogan, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks, Francesca. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Chris.
Chris Brogan's next book is Social Media 101, coming out soon from Wiley. You can hear more of our extended interview with Chris Brogan at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.